Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. There's some mad technical difficulties going on with Skype that has been happening for the last week, apparently, that I've been taken off, and we are doing this via speakerphone, so I can keep my hands free. Okay, now, my very special guest, if I recall correctly, should be on the line there as well. What the heck is her name? Dr. Manjua Samantha Lawton, I think. Are you there?
Hi.
All right, well, we've got you there. Would you introduce yourself and let us know your websites and such?
Hi, I'm, the long name is Dr. Manjua Samantha Lawton, that's a hyphenated surname, but just call me Manjua. And what's easy to remember is punkscience.com. That's all one word, punkscience.com. So I'm sometimes called the Punk Science Lady. That's one of my nicknames.
What exactly is punk science?
How long have you got?
Specifically, we have 2 hours.
Well, punk science, because, I mean, there's a lot of, as you know, there's a lot of stuff that's told to us that's sort of fed to us as orthodox science, you know. And I was looking at all this, and my background is I'm a medical doctor, and I could see through what people were being fed and realize that there was a whole load of stuff that people never get to hear about. And that's the connection between what we call science, like the cutting-edge physics. And that was really starting to look like the ancient esoteric wisdom, you know. We talked about consciousness and, you know, sort of non-local effects and all of these things. And but I knew that the establishment wasn't gonna accept all this. So it's punk science. It's out of the box. It's radical thinking. You know, it's there on the page, you know, so I call my book Punk Science because, you know, the orthodoxy aren't going to like it, but, you know, there it is.
Like rebellion science.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So we're not going to expect you to put razor blades on your arms and go dance around in a mosh pit, are you?
No, not tonight. Don't feel like it. I have been in a mosh pit before, believe me.
I'm sure we will have. Now, speaking of punk science and such, because this is actually a topic that's of great interest to me, because I've met so many educated people, so many doctors, so many scientists, who think that all the other doctors and scientists are completely crazy and unthinking morons, which is aghast to most of the public who think, if I've got a problem, go see a doctor who will give me a drug.
Yeah,
totally.
There's a growing number of people. I would say it's still the minority, but you know, there's a lot of people sort of unhappy within the sort of medical profession itself. But I mean, that's why I started out. I really started to look and see that doctors who were around me really didn't know much about physics. So their world really stops at the molecule. You know, they don't look any deeper. So that's all they're thinking about. Does this molecule, which is a drug, fit that molecule in the body? And if so, all well and good. And that's all they're thinking about. But there's just so much more to that. In orthodox science itself, because, of course, we've had quantum physics for almost a century now, which looks much deeper to the atom even, and tells us that reality is not like that at all. It's not solid. But that just doesn't filter through to most doctors. And although some scientists know about it, it's like, have you ever heard of the phrase, shut up and calculate? You know, they just sort of, that's the day job. They go home and then they don't think about what it all means.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the situation. So it's really, punk science really is kind of like describing a movement of punk scientists around the world that have been talking about it for quite a few years. We're actually making punk science into a movie at the moment. Myself and my partner we've been around the world. We went to New Zealand. I spoke at New Zealand a couple of years ago, and we interviewed Amit Goswami there. We've been interviewing all sorts of people around the world, you know, who are really, you know, the punks, the rebels who are in the system and just sort of seen and gone, hey, you know, there's just so much more to reality than this that you know, we're telling the public, and, you know, we're actually, that it's all to do with funding at the end of the day, you know, what gets funded. And if you don't do what's in the sort of straitjacket, I've definitely spoken to physicists who've been warned that if they don't stick to what they're told to do, then they're going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of threat out there, and I was wondering as well, what happens to a doctor if you're young, super intelligent, getting straight A's and things of that nature, which you do need to, or at least in New Zealand you do, in order to get into medical school in the first place. What motivates them to get into those fields, or in any field, really, for that matter, of a scientific nature that requires a lot of cognitive ability? What motivates them to get into it, and conversely, how do they lose their motivation once they're in there?
So you're asking, like, why do intelligent young people then just lose their interest in science?
After they've kind of studied for near on a decade and gotten into it, and then they just kind of go, I don't really care anymore, though. The doctors stop reading the resource materials, the other scientists stop caring as well. You know, basically they don't want to stay up to date. They're simply there for the 9-to-5 sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because when obviously I studied and got good grades in school, but just as things were getting interesting, just as they were talking about quantum physics, you know, so I studied physics and chemistry at the age of 18, they stopped telling us. They go, well, then you get into quantum physics and that's too complicated for you. So, you know, I was left, and a lot of my colleagues at medical students were left with that picture that everything was solid, which just isn't the case in physics, not been the case for a long time. And then you get into med school and the big shock happens, because what you were doing in England, we call it A-levels, where, you know, you're sitting for sort of 17, 18 years old to get into university, and you're right, to get into med school, you have to sort of get pretty high grades. What we're doing an entire year or term, you know, we were doing in 1 hour's lecture, and that's the onslaught that happens to you in med school, and, you know, the workload is so much, and all it is repetition. You're not thinking about what you're learning, really. You're just learning facts and regurgitating them. And then you get an exam every few weeks, and you just, it's, you know, survival from one exam to another. And you're just thinking about getting through those exams, which are designed to actually weed out, you know, a certain percentage of students anyway. So, I mean, I was there. I was really thinking in terms of orthodoxy. I wasn't interested in anything like that. But I was also interested in fitness. So here I was. I was down from northern England, a little place, village in northern England. I came down to London to study. We did actually have a sort of family place in London, so I was sort of familiar with the area. And I was in one of the top London medical schools in the early 90s. And I got there. This is what, you know, my whole family had been focused on. Both my parents are doctors. My grandfather was a doctor. All my cousins are doctors. And I got there, and I was like, oh, I'm 18. I got my dream. I'm in med school. This ain't right for me. It just felt so wrong. So luckily for me, somebody signed me up for a yoga class. You know how when you get to college and everybody sort of, you know, signed you up for different clubs? And you've got to understand, I was a total skeptic at that point, a total skeptic. And I walked into this yoga class thinking I was going to do some stretches. And I ended up with a Kundalini experience. I don't know if you know what that is.
It's a type of pasta, isn't it?
Sorry?
It's a type of pasta, isn't it?
I've never heard it being described like that. But, yeah, sometimes pasta comes in spirals. So, you know, and the spiral absolutely has to do with Kundalini. So it's a type of energy. I'd never heard of this. I was a complete skeptic. Richard Dawkins was like my idol, which is ironic because I ended up on TV with him later. But, you know, so I, you know, ended up with this energy going through me, and I had, you know, this sudden awakening. So at 18 years old, in med school in London for the first few weeks, and suddenly the light was switched on, and I saw everything in a completely different way. I saw, you know, everything is connected and, you know, the things that the ancients have been talking about for a long time. This is someone who is a complete skeptic who saw all that was nonsense before. So I've been on both sides, you know. I know what it is like to look at people and think, what are they talking about? Why are they so nuts, you know? And I've also been called nuts myself. So I've been, you know, both parts of it. So I went through the whole med school with this kind of growing awareness, and I realized that, you know, you have to bring the two together. You have to bring science and spirit together in order to move forward. And initially I set out to help patients. That's what I was aiming to do, but I ended up doing a lot more than I bargained for, really. I ended up finding a lot more. I don't know if you know about my theories about black holes, and we can talk about that later if you want.
Well, why not now?
So, yeah, I set out to just to provide a framework, a really simple framework that was contemporary, that people were going to relate to, that was looking at the science of consciousness. I know you've discussed that with Anthony Peake on this show before, looking at how quantum physics and consciousness are related. Just make it really easy, make it really funky, and, you know, sort of easy to understand. And I got to writing the book, and in the meantime, my whole world changed around. You know, when you actually set out to do something and it actually happens, you know, sometimes in order to get there, get on the path, when you step on the path, the universe responds, and the whole universe did. So it ended up completely changing my life. I left medicine. This is years after, obviously, I became qualified as a doctor, and I've been studying these subjects all this time. And I ended up really getting into the subject of black holes. And so that led to a whole new theory of black holes because, you know, we're often told that black holes are actually destructive. I don't know if you've sort of read anything into black holes at all.
Well, I think black holes are essentially like a celestial psychopath. They just suck you in and crush you.
Yeah, that's what we're told, you know. And so what happened was I was studying the actual data from black holes, and it actually was the complete opposite. When we actually look at black holes with our telescope, the actual evidence shows that it's a complete opposite. There's actually so much light and radiation coming out of black holes. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't.
No, so this has been going on fairly recently, so it's not really filtered down to the public yet, because, you know, when they get so entrenched in a theory, they don't really want to let go of it.
Well, then they lose their credibility. It's like, oh, I've been preaching BS for 10 years. Nobody will ever trust me again. Have you heard of the scientist who cried wolf?
Exactly. Exactly. It's like they don't really want to, because, you know, there's funding and everything embedded in the system now. So they're so entrenched, they can't really go from there. Even when the evidence comes up that black holes are not destructive, they've actually got loads of radiation, they're coming up with all sorts of strange theories to explain this, which is that, you know, as the stuff goes down the plug hole, the black holes actually burp on their food. I mean, that is, if you actually go and Google that, you'll find that black holes actually burp on their food. You know, just have a look, you know. So they're doing all these amazing contortions, you know, to try and stick with their theories in the face of the evidence.
It's like Cirque du Science.
Yeah. It's like Ptolemy's epicycles all over again. Whenever they find something, you know, they always say things that just completely surprises them, like antimatter coming out of thunderstorms, which we can go into later, but I mean, you know, that's one thing. They sort of go, oh, yeah, we were expecting that, actually. We had to, yeah, we knew that was going to happen. It's like, yeah, right. And then they do this, like, convoluted explanation as to why that's happening. So, you know, that theory just doesn't work in the face of the evidence. But at the moment, they're not ready to give up their cherished beliefs, which is what they are, their beliefs. And when the evidence actually shows to the contrary, they can't really let go of it. Which is why I think people like me, it's like, you know, there's a few people working on black hole theories being creative. At the moment, but I think that's why it's come. So, you know, I suddenly had a very sort of big flash of insight, and I realized that black holes are actually the creative hubs of the universe. And what happens is most of them exist beyond the... Sorry?
Oh, we're coming to a break now, unfortunately. Oh, wait, hold on. No, we're having some technical difficulties, which means we don't have no break coming, which means you can continue.
Okay. Basically what I realized in this sort of insight is that black holes are actually creative. That actually most of them, have you heard of dark matter or dark energy?
No, but I heard that the Massive Hadron Collider that they built like for $9 billion or something found a new type of a matter that kind of appeared and then disappeared and that they can't do anything with, and they called it doesn't matter.
I think there's a lot of that in science. So don't get me started on the LHC. I'll go on all night. But anyway, you don't need big, you know, colliders and this sort of thing to do good science. What's missing is they can't put the pieces together. So if they looked at the data and understood the data, they wouldn't need these expensive machines if they had the insight to actually see the patterns. So what I saw was the patterns in the data, and I suddenly realized what the pattern was. And then what you have to understand is that the speed of light isn't the speed limit of the universe. That's the first thing. And, you know, so actually most of the universe actually exists beyond the speed of light. That's why 98% of the universe is actually missing. We don't know what it's made of. You know, 98% of the universe is dark matter and dark energy.
Mm.
Well, you know, what we're made of is the 0.3% that is the stars and everything like that. 0.3%. You know, your body, everything that's physical you see around you. So what I realize is what that is stuff that's actually beyond the speed of light. And this is actually some orthodox scientists who actually say this too. And even Einstein... himself actually said that the speed of light isn't the speed limit of the universe. So what I realised is when you go beyond the speed of light, it's actually super bright. It's actually a different type of light that's in higher dimensions. And what black holes do is they're actually the creative force that brings this light from higher dimensions into our dimension below the speed of light. So what happens when the light gets to the edge of our dimension, something I'm now calling the perception horizon because that's a limitation of our perceptions, not the limitation of the universe, is you get the particle of light splitting into a particle of matter and a particle of antimatter. Not a particle of don't matter, but you can have that if you want. And so a particle of matter. And this happens at the speed of light. And guess what? This is what we see in our telescopes. We see electrons coming out of black holes at the speed of light. And the astrophysicists do not know why this is happening.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? Well, it means they've got everything the wrong way around. It means they've got absolutely everything the wrong way around. Instead of black holes being destructive, you know, if black holes were destructive, why would they be at the center of every galaxy? And why would there be a direct correlation between the size of the black hole at the center of the galaxy and the size of the galaxy?
Well, I was wondering about this as well. Most things that I've learned in my life to be true have turned out to be the exact opposite. Why should this be any different?
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, as I said, they're so invested in the old paradigm that they keep doing contortions even in the face of all this evidence. So the other thing that happens at the black hole that I'm putting forward is that it kind of breathes. At the edge of the black hole, the matter and the antimatter that split from the light, the photon, they combine again, and they form light in the form of gamma ray bursts. Now, we see these gamma ray bursts all over the sky. And over 50 years now, we've been trying to figure out what is creating these gamma ray bursts. Well, I'm saying that they're actually coming from the breathing process of black holes. And you see, sorry to say this, but, you know, the physicists only understand things that are violent. They only understand gobbling black holes, eating black holes, you know, explosions. What they don't understand, and you can look this up and see that this is absolutely puzzled to them, what they don't understand is that this is a breathing process that's actually sometimes producing the matter and antimatter, sometimes producing the gamma rays. Now, what an explosion should look like in their charts is that you have this huge burst of gamma rays and then they die away. That's what an explosion would look like. But you don't. You actually get these oscillations. And they can't understand why that's happening because their paradigm is completely wrong. Instead of thinking of explosions, the actual edge of a black hole is just breathing one way or the other. And sometimes it's producing matter and antimatter. That's when we see the X-rays and the antimatter coming out. And then sometimes it's producing gamma rays, and that's when we see the gamma ray burst. And because it's breathing between the two, that's why we get the results that we do. But they look at the data, and they can't understand it, so they put it to one side, and they go, okay, we're sticking to our old violent universe paradigm, even though there's no evidence that nobody's ever seen a black hole gobbling another black hole. But what we do see is loads of gamma ray bursts everywhere. So you know what I mean? That they're not really letting go of their very cherished ideas, but this is the theory that I'm putting forward. So I've been speaking about it for over 10 years now.
Has any form of planetary or star-like body ever emerged from a black hole? Like they breathe, do they give birth?
Absolutely. You've got it absolutely right. One of the other puzzles is that they've seen things called hypervelocity stars. And from our own galaxy being ejected out at very, very high speeds, The other thing that they've seen of, has absolutely puzzled them, because they don't understand black holes are given birth. The Mayan people used to call the center of the galaxy the cosmic mother, you know, and so did the Gnostics, you know. So this is really rediscovered knowledge, you know, with the modern telescope data that we've got. We're actually going back to ancient knowledge. So what you can actually see just 1 light-year away from the center of the Milky Way are blue stars. Now, blue stars are new stars. So you can see new stars being created at the center of the galaxy, so near the black hole at the center of the galaxy. Now, if black holes were destructive, this would make no sense. You know, so black holes are creative, and they also create two what's called bipolar jets. Now, whenever you see a galaxy, you know there's kind of like a spiral around the center, do you know, where you see a lot of spiral galaxies. Now, if you can imagine that there's like two sort of jets coming out, they're actually going at right angles to the disk, as it were. So they're called bipolar jets. There's nothing to do with manic depression, in case you're wondering about that. Now, what's really, really interesting is that the black hole, I call it a black hole principle, because it doesn't just end there. What I'm saying is that the same pattern goes throughout all of reality. So you see this same pattern happening in planets, in stars. Our sun gives these coronal mass ejections, which are electrons at the speed of light, antimatter, matter cycling. You know, it's the same pattern. Sunspots, it's black holes on black holes. Sunspots are mini black holes. Guess what? They eject electrons. You know, you've got all the planets that are giving out ejections. You've got, you know, the same sort of patterns. You can see these bipolar jets around new stars, around old stars. Nobody knows why they're doing this, but it totally fits with the black hole principle. Everything at every level, even atoms, down to atoms. What do we know about atoms? They breathe up and down. They eject. They have electrons and positrons, and matter and antimatter flip. You know, when we see things in a different way, we see that they actually, nature just has one pattern at every single level, just expressing itself at different levels. It's actually quite simple.
Yeah, I always find that very funny as well. You know, you ask somebody, how do you know an atom looks like a ball? And they go, oh, well, I've seen a photo of it. Really? How did they zoom in that far in order to get a photo of an atom?
Oh, no, that's not fun. And in any case, it's a load of empty space. You know, it's a load of nothing, you know. Everybody knows that. You can't really, there's nothing to photograph. It's information.
They seem to be like simple building blocks that are infinitesimal, and what was I going to say here? Oh, yeah. The human body is very similar to this, to the universe in a lot of ways. Like the brain cell structure, I think, looks very much like the structure of the universe kind of thing. Like if you were pull back and take a picture of a brain cell or a picture of the universe, they'd match up and look very aligned. Also, cells are all built up of other cells, and all those other little cells that build them up are also built of other cells. So it's, and so on and so forth, infinitely down the chain. And my contention is that life is an infinite sort of spectrum, just by matter of size. So whatever our subjective experience is, you know, I'm subjectively Vinnie Eastwood. You're subjectively Manja. And we're subjectively here having a conversation. Yet there's a whole bunch of cells within our bodies that also have their own consciousness and maybe even self-actualization, or who knows. And thus the universe is very, very similar in such a way too. It's infinite in scale, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's these beautiful pictures that people have done showing the similarity between neurons and structures out in space. And you know, one of the beautiful things that binds us all together is phi ratio. You know, you can just even see that in our own bodies. You know, the fact that our dimensions actually reflect that. And, you know, the brain also, you know, one of the things ideas I'm putting forward is that epilepsy might be a sort of black hole discharge of the parietal lobes of the brain. So when you have an epileptic, somebody has an epileptic fit, they release a load of electrons, just as in a black hole. So, and we've, you know, got evidence to show that epileptic fits are actually linked to solar activity. So that's the other thing about it. Everything, absolutely everything, is breathing in and out. Everything is linked. So, you know, something that is, and everything has infinity at the center, like you're saying. It's this infinite universe. Every single black hole is producing light from infinity. And the infinity at the center of every black hole, whether it be out in space in the center of a galaxy, whether it be in our own atoms or our chakras, you know, the idea of chakras is, are they black holes, you know? So, you know, something that's so small, this is the same infinity. We're all connected. You know, we have this, like you're saying, a subjective experience that we're separate. But, you know, that same infinity is just is everywhere. It's expressing itself through this one principle in myriads and myriads and myriads of different ways. But if you look closely and look again at all the data, and I'm talking about hard scientific data here. I'm talking about telescopes that are picking up the ejections that are coming out of the sun. The actual you know, composition of the sun, we thought we knew what was going on. We thought it was this big, you know, hydrogen bomb, effectively, but it's not. The actual composition of the sun, recently they've had to throw their hands up and say, you know, it's got too much oxygen. The sun has got too much. We don't know the chemical composition of the sun. And if we don't know that, we don't know the first thing about the sun. These are scientists. These are actual orthodox scientists who are saying, we actually don't know. It doesn't get translated to the public because too much, because they want to keep this mystique that they know what's going on. But actually, sometimes it...
Well, this sounds like... It sounds like somebody is a massive religious preacher of an obscure religion, and people suddenly find out that he's a fraud, and he keeps it from his congregation so he can keep defrauding them.
And keep the money as well. I mean, I have to say some people are getting this out. There was actually a program on the BBC about 2 years ago that said, what if everything we know about the universe is wrong? Because the data is so overwhelming now that, you know, the microwave data from the that was supposed to be from the Big Bang 15 billion years ago, it's just confirmed that actually there's alignments that correspond to structures today. There shouldn't be. You know, these microwaves, guess what? There's microwaves coming out of our Milky Way. Could these microwaves, the background microwave data, not be something from 15 billion years ago? You know, the party's over, nothing's happening, but from a continuous creation process that's happening in every moment. Therefore, there are alignments with current structures, and that is in the data. You know, so our ideas of the universe, when we actually go to prove them, are being disproved. And when they're disproved, it's like they look at the data in disbelief. By the way, they call this alignment the axis of evil.
What are they going to do? Try and invade it?
Exactly. They call it that because, you know, they can't get rid of it. They've tried to, you know, first of all, nobody believed it. And then they, you know, said that the scientists had discovered it. I can actually make predictions with this theory that have come true. I've made predictions in my book and in my papers, and then NASA's gone out and explored something, and they found the evidence that what I predicted a few years before was actually true. So, for example, you know, the same principle happens on our planet too. You know, it sounds crazy, we're sitting on a black hole, but, you know, actually there's so much evidence for... the black hole activity on this planet is quite amazing.
What do you mean? Do you mean Earth is like a black hole? Like it's got a black hole inside it or something?
Yeah. If you stop thinking about Earth as of black holes as destructive, and realize that black holes are actually it's actually a process of a dynamic creation. You start to think of things differently. So our Earth and the Earth's upper atmosphere, we started to see things called terrestrial gamma ray flashes. Once we got, you know, the satellites that were above the clouds, they started to notice that every time there was a thunderstorm, they would see things that were really, really bright. And so different types of lightning, different... Now, what they found as well is gamma ray flashes, gamma ray bursts, that are just as powerful. This is in an Earth's upper atmosphere, just as powerful as in black holes out in space. Amazing, isn't it? So we've got the same things happening in thunderstorms. Now, the other thing that comes out of thunderstorms, which you probably know about, is lightning. Now, lightning are fast-moving electrons. And just as in the black hole principle, now the black hole principle, if I, you know, one of the features is it's breathing between gamma ray bursts and fast-moving electrons and antimatter. Now, when I wrote my book, we had found the gamma ray bursts and we found the electrons. It's called lightning. Now, people have done some experiments to, you know, the way that we're told lightning is created is we're told it's a build-up of static electricity in clouds. People have done some experiments, and actually some people have lost their lives putting, you know, kites into a thunderstorm. Now, you can imagine that's quite a dangerous thing to do, to try and measure the build-up of electricity. It's nowhere near enough to create a lightning bolt. Yet they tell the public that this is how lightning is created, even though the experiments themselves have disproved this. So they don't really know how lightning is created. Now, if you look at the black hole principle, we would predict gamma ray flashes, we predict fast-moving electrons at almost the speed of light, which is what lightning is. Now, the other thing that we predict is antimatter. Now, 2010, NASA finally went up to investigate gamma ray bursts, and to their absolute surprise, they found the signature of antimatter coming out of thunderstorms associated with terrestrial gamma ray flashes. This is just one of the predictions that this theory has made. You know, nobody knew that antimatter was coming out of thunderstorms when I first wrote the theory, you know, but it was something that was predictable, because if you know the simple pattern, you can start predicting all sorts of things. So the Earth itself has gotten lots of signs of this black hole dynamo activity. From the center of the planet to actually the Earth's upper atmosphere.
All right, well, coming to break the first time in this hour, we have Dr. Mangia for an entire hour up as well. So, ladies, just you stay there and listen to the wonderful commercials we have. And we'll be right back after them. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is great for the economy, because everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Dr. Mangia. Welcome back.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were we talking about, the black hole in the centre of the Earth, like... The whole Gaia complex, you know, the Earth Mother and the Greek myths about how Gaia just sort of spit out everything, is that something that you've kind of come to wonder about, is how myths and legends actually seem to have a scientific basis behind them? They're just a little bit obscure?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my new book is... You know, in a broader picture, my new book is really going to go into looking at ancient people and how they were writing about, you know, the Anunnaki and all these different beings, which I think are multidimensional beings. And so, you know, even from that to, you know, the whole black hole principle was there in the Gnostic texts, and as I said, the Mayan people actually would speak of the center of the galaxy as the Great Mother. Now, this is before we've had the evidence that actually shows that this is the case. How did they know that, for example, the Gnostic text says that the goddess Sophia fell from the center of the galaxy. She swirled around. She fell through the cosmic bound, and then she created this world. Now, that sounds hugely like the process of light coming from the center of the galaxy, the black hole, swirling around. You know, instead of an accretion disk, it's really a creation disk, going through what I call the perception horizon, which is at the speed of light, and then coming into our world. It's the same process. So they were talking about goddesses, and now we're talking about particle physics. That's the only difference. It's pretty amazing what's been there before.
Have you ever heard of the game, the children's game Chinese Whispers, where you whisper one thing into one person's ear, and then they'll whisper that, they'll try and remember what you said, and they whisper it into the next person's ear, and by the time you get to the 10th person, it's something completely different?
Yeah, definitely played that one.
Yeah, so is that basically what we're going on here? We're doing some kind of scientific, mythological Chinese whispers through the ages?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is, as I'm doing my research, it's not so much how much we've lost through that process, translation process, how much people have actually kept it going. That's what really is extraordinary. I mean, you know, sometimes oral tradition can last, you know, hundreds, if not we don't know, but I mean, it could have even lasted thousands of years. And people repeat things. And there's actually a study, you can't really find the paper now, but I saw an anthropologist actually studied the Kurdish people, and she was looking at how they kept the oral tradition. And actually, she found that through generations, people will keep the same story going through the chanting and song rather than just speaking. They would keep it like word perfect generation after generation, which is quite amazing. You know, so it's actually what surprising me is actually just how well kept some of these stories are. But if it method away from consciousness, away from spirit, and what do we find? We probe deeper into the universe, and what do we get? At the heart of every atom is information that's interacting with our consciousness, to have some people conclude that consciousness is fundamental to reality. And then we get relativity, which says that it depends on your perspective as to what the universe, how the universe behaves, which is pretty amazing, again, linked to consciousness. And we get all this data, which actually tells us that the universe is not at all what we thought it was. You know, for the data that's coming out now is saying axis of evil is true. Big Bang didn't happen. You have to throw everything out. So the more that we're going deeper, we're using the scientific method, the more that we're coming back to these concepts that have been in ancient mysticism for thousands of years, which is really, really quite exciting.
Well, the problem with discovery is that the people whose careers are based upon that discovery not being made get really angry, jealous, and defensive, and can sometimes destroy your entire life. Have you ever had any of these people try to come after you or discredit you or the organizations what you're talking about?
Oh, yes, yeah. I've had the entire medical profession. It was quite a strange thing that happened to me, because it was my personal life and my professional life came together. And about just over 10 years ago, I was working as a medical general practitioner, and I was married to a general practitioner, and who was going one way. He was going into the pharmaceutical industry, kind of thing. And the marriage came to an end. And so we split. And so that wasn't the end of the story, though, because he started to tell my parents, who were both doctors as well, that I'd lost it. That, you know, as I said, I'm a mystic. I was actually a trained healer as well. So I was actually seeing people on the side of my medical practice. I wasn't doing healing. It sounds strange, but I wasn't doing healing in my medical practice, but you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I was actually doing orthodox medicine as a GP, and then I'd see people as a trained holistic practitioner on the side. So, you know, extraordinary things were happening in my practice, like shape-shifting and, you know, crazy things. And I would tell my husband about this, and, you know, little did I know he was actually taking notes. And, you know, and I didn't know quite, you know, how way out it sounded to him. And so when we actually divorced, he told my parents that I was, you know, unstable and this and that. And they insisted that I have a mental health check. And I ended up having being referred to the General Medical Council of England, and who were just really, you know, nasty piece of work. And most of the psychiatrists who saw me just said, you're fine, you're actually completely normal. And there was just one psychiatrist who just seemed to have it in for me and had already made up her mind as to, you know, that I was, had, you know, bipolar, whatever. And her initial assessment was that I had bipolar disorder. So I was the whole time of this time, I was told not to work. So I lost my house. I had to quit my job because I didn't want to, you know, say that I'd, because I wasn't ill, you know, so I didn't want to go on sick leave. They forced me to go on sick leave. I lost absolutely everything, you know, so my, I just got divorced as well. So I really got to rock bottom, and they eventually said to me, we can't find anything wrong with you, but there must be something in you know, what your ex-husband has said. He went into my computer and he got all my stuff about David Icke and reptilians and all this sort of stuff and showed it to them. So I was in this strange situation of, you know, the psychiatrist asking me, do you think that people are going to come after you? And I'm going, what do you think is happening right now, you know? And it was this bizarre thing. But so in the end, they said, we can't find anything wrong with you, but we're going to monitor you. If you go for any job, you have to tell them that you're under psychiatric surveillance. You can't leave the country. You can't do this. If we tell you to take drugs, you're going to have to take drugs, otherwise you can't work. And you know what? I just knew what I had to do. And it was really hard after all that training, but I quit the medical profession. And it's been the most liberating experience. It's been completely frightening, like, how am I going to pay my bills? But, you know, ever since then, in you know, I've just been, the universe has supported me in extraordinary ways. But I've had what I've needed, and I've made a tremendous sacrifice to get this book out, get Punk Science out, and then I wrote my story with the second book, The Genius Groove. And, yeah, absolutely. But now if people... I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Dublin. I was at a conference in Dublin, and it was a European Commission conference with Angela Merkel and... You know, all these sort of people for heads of state and ex-heads of state. It's a long story how I got there, but it was a friend of my partner's was sort of organizing this. They met like many years ago, and he invited me to speak. Very unusual conference for the sort of thing that I normally do. And one of the physicists asked me when he found out after my presentation what I was about. He actually said publicly they shouldn't have been invited to speak there and that people like me should be banned. So I still get that. And but you know what? The majority of people have been speaking around the world for 10 years now, over 10 years. You know, have just welcomed me and welcomed these ideas, and a very minority of people who are against it.
Right. Well, we're coming to another break now. We've got you for another whole hour. This is quite an interesting conversation because it's really about the nature of the universe and how science and mysticism really are becoming one through just simple, logical deduction study of what's actually there, what's actually fact. And I found that what's funny about this all is, as I mentioned before, everything you think you know winds up being proven wrong at some point. And I think that's probably the reason why I no longer have any rigidly held beliefs. Because I know that they can change at any point with some sufficient evidence. We'll be right back, folks, after the break, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.